Good evening. That's so nice of you to answer. Poetry is famously highly condensed. Dictum equal condensare, as Pound declares in his ABC of reading, though my colleague Michael Hulse informs me this is bad German. But the first time I read the poems in Andrew Motion's collection Dangerous Play, Penguin, 1985, I was, like many other readers, astonished to find myself transported so far, as it were, by so few words. These are narratives in verse, for the most part. In some of them, it's as if a whole novel has been telescoped into a few vivid stanzas. This economy is generous. It allows us to feel partly responsible for the poetry's effect, which, of course, we are. That's the great thing about poetry. It's a collaboration between two imaginations, one transmitting and one receiving, and as such is a powerful corrective to the mutual incomprehension which is too frequently our lot. In his office as poet laureate, Andrew Motion, who has described writing poetry as a biological thing, like developing a headache or the flu, travels constantly, spreading the contagion the length and breadth of Albion. Now he's here, prepared to be infected. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Motion.
Thank you, Peter, very much indeed. Very nice to be here, infectious or not. What I'm going to do is to read for about 40 minutes from this new book of poems called Public Property. And in here and there in the reading, I'll read some things that I've written since it came out. There's a common illusion, of course, that all of you who've published books know, and those of you who haven't published books yet anticipate, which is that when a book comes out, you suppose that the people reading it think that it was finished the day before it appeared, but in fact it's been about a year mouldering in somebody's file before it sees the light of day. So there's been about a year between finishing this book and now. It's divided into four bits. And the first of these bits is substantially filled by a long autobiographical childhood poem called A Long Story. I've written a lot about romantic literature and about John Keats in particular. And my advertised interest in Keats rather concealed my interest in Wordsworth, which is just as great, if not greater, because he's a greater poet. And I thought that, like Wordsworth, it would be interesting to try and identify spots of time in my childhood. Those moments which stay with us because they're self-sufficiently interesting, and also because they seem to act as some kind of template or filter or basis for adult wisdom. How we interpret our adult lives depends in a rather interesting way on the episodes that we remember from our childhood, if we remember any. Well, I remember very few, and the few that I've remembered, I've tried to write about. And I'll read one of them, which is the last part of this poem, which is called Serenade. It's called Serenade because Serenade is the name of a creature that my mother had, which was somewhere between horse-sized and pony-sized. I think there is a name for this thing, which I've forgotten, but its humanized name was Serenade. And this is a poem about this creature, and also, and in particular, about the person who used to turn up to shoe her. This was not a Joe Gargery Flaming Forge kind of person, but a little skinny guy who used to turn up, more or less when he chose to, and do what was then, and I suppose probably still is, called cold shoeing. There were the two ponies, and there was Serenade, which belonged to my mother. Though who belonged would be better, in view of the girlish head lift she had, and her flounce to and fro in the lumpy field, and that big womanish rump I always gave a wide berth to. When the blacksmith came to shoe her, which was seldom in summer, but otherwise often, she would let him hoist and stretch out first one hind leg, and then the other, with a definitely melancholy, embarrassed restraint. The blacksmith was ferret-faced and rat-bodied, hardly man enough to keep aloft the great weight of 1 foot at a time, though he did keep it sort of aloft, crouched over double and bent at the knees to make a peculiar angle which held each hoof still on his battle-scarred apron. He would set up shop under the covered entranceway between our house and the stable block, a ramshackle clabbered affair, black or black weathering to green, with swallows' mud villages proliferating in the rafters. I liked it there in the drive-through, which was also where we parked the car, but not on his days, for the oil maps on the dusty cement, brilliant as the wet skin of a trout, and for the puzzling swallow shit patterns, and most of all for that place by the corner drain where a grass snake had appeared once, an electric green, sleepy-looking marble which, when it disappeared, left a print of itself that stayed in the mind forever. The blacksmith always did cold shoeing, prizing off each thin moon crescent, then carving the hoof with a bone-handled, long-bladed knife. The miracle of no pain. Serenade gone loose in her skin, her strength out of her so she seemed suspended in water, her hypnotized breathing steady, the smell of piss and musty hay and ammonia sweat coming off her, her head dropping down, eyes half closed now, and me, a boy, watching the earth-stained sole of her hoof turning pure white as the blacksmith pared and trimmed, leaving the nervous diamond of the frog well alone, but showing me, just by looking, how even to touch that, much worse cut it, would wake her and break the spell and our two heads with it. Our collie dog sat near where the snake had been, ravenous black and white, all ears, sometimes fidgeting her two slim front feet, glancing away as if about to dash off, then twisting back, licking her lips and swallowing with a half whine. She knew better than to get under anyone's feet, but when the blacksmith had done with his cutting and offered a new shoe and fiddled it downwards or sideways and hammered it with quick hits which drove the nail points clean through, but these could be filed off later and were. When this was all done, he kicked the clippings across the cement, and now it was the collie's turn to show a sad restraint, taking one delicate piece between her pink lips, ashamed to be a slave of appetite, and curving away into the yard to eat it in private. The blacksmith straightened himself, one hand smoothing the small of his back, the other picking a few remaining nails from between his own darker lips, then slapped Serenade on the flank with his red palm, rising her from her trance, running his fingers up her mane and over her ears, giving each a soft tug and saying, "She'll do," or "Good lady," or "There's a girl." Whereupon my mother herself appeared to pay him. Their hands met and touched and parted, and something passed between them, and the blacksmith took off his apron with its colours of a battered tin bowl, folded it and carried it before him in a lordly fashion, using it as a cushion for his collapsed bag of hammers, clippers, knives, files, pliers and nails, to the van which he had parked in the lane some distance from us, while my mother untied the halter and led her horse away. There was a crisp clip-clop over the stable yard, and a train of hoof prints with the neat shoes obvious to me, who had stayed behind with nothing better to do than look. This was Serenade, who would later throw my mother as they jumped out of a wood into sunlight, and who, taking all possible pains not to trample her down or even touch her, was nevertheless the means to an end, which was death. Now I am as old as my mother was then, at the time of her fall, and I can see Serenade clearly in her own later life. Poor, dumb, creature, nobody, blamed. Or could easily like any more either, which meant nobody came to talk to her much in the spot she eventually found under the spiky may tree in the field, and still less came to shoe her, so her hooves grew long and crinkled round the edges like wet cardboard, except they were hard, while she just stood there, not knowing what she had done or went off with her girlish flounce and conker-coloured arse, waiting for something important to happen, only nothing ever did beyond the next day and the next, and one thing leading to another. Well, it's a dragon at the gate to read a long poem, and I'm sorry about that. I'm going to read another one of that sort of length at the end, I warn you. But in between, I'll read some things which are a bit shorter. I spend a lot of time, as you might imagine, thinking about my predecessors as laureate and sometimes envying the comparatively easy time they had, in the sense that if I'd been somebody writing in a culture at a time when there was a more consensual idea of what language might be, public language might be, it might have been the job of writing public poems might have been a bit easier, though I have to say a good deal less interesting too. I know this oversimplifies it, but when you think about Tennyson, and in particular about his poem The Charge of the Light Brigade, which I suppose is the best known of his laureate poems, and it's a good poem, it's a very good public poem, what he says in that poem is something which doesn't want to brook much opposition to it. If I were to write a poem about such an event now, part of the difficulty of doing it would be to do with reconciling the fact that we live in a much more diverse culture than he did, and in an acknowledged way we do that. So the idea of this consensual language is much more complicated. So this is, as I say, something I think about. Anyway, recently, a friend of mine came back from their work, saying that they'd been reading a book about the Crimean War. And did I know that as the Light Brigade set off in their famous charge up the Valley of Death, as Tennyson borrowingly calls it, a little dog, a terrier dog, broke out of the stables in which the Light Brigade had been keeping their horses and ran alongside them all the way up the valley and turned around when it got to the end, having been running safely below the line of shot and shell. And then ran all the way back beside the survivors, and then did, I've no idea what, got on with its doggy life. No, I didn't know that, but what a good idea for a poem, and what a good idea for having a conversation with Tennyson about this very subject. So this is what I wrote, which is called, as it should be, The Dog of the Light Brigade, and as it should do if I have the energy to do it, gallops. We have to remember when Ragland and others decided their hour had come and did as they felt and ordered their messmates and countrymen, yes, the noble 600, most of whom never had even so much as imagined what shooting and shelling were like away from the shires, much less endured it, when they had advanced them up to the mouth of the innocent valley known later, thanks to the laureate Alfred Lord Tennyson, thanks be to him, as the Valley of Death, the din of their bugling and clanking and neighing and stamping and shouting stretched back to the stables a distance behind them, and woke there the pampered fox terrier kept by the men as a mascot, who, thinking that this was the point of his madcap existence revealed at last, sprang from his bed among titbits of horse dung, squeezed through a crack in the ill-hammered planks of a door, then again through the arms of a boy, and sped off to join them. This was the dog who was never surprised in the barracks. Most nights indulged with a tableside seat in the mess, he gazed on the faces of men whose acceptable practice was drinking until one collapsed, whose mustachioed mouths repeated the same snorting farmyard of noises over and over, viz. Frenchmen and Russians and women and Prussians and Turks and women, until they were cancelled one by the other or smudged in the baccy fug wine fumes and high-collared heat of the moment. But nothing had ever prepared him for this, for the firecracker racket that rattled the air they rode into, the po-faced hilarious crash of men who could empty an armful of bottles straight off and not bat an eyelid, the curious antics of horses in kneeling, or slithering sideways, or stopping stock still, which is why he kept pace with them all the way through to the cannon line, bouncing the heathery turf and yap-yapping his head off, a maddening brown and white blur at the corner of everyone's eye, and then turning round when the rest of them also turned round and skittering back, bounding higher this time to get clear of the men he could no longer play with, until losing patience, and anyway, puffed with the effort of running, although the whole business had lasted 15 or so minutes at best, and then strutting off to the stables to sample the titbits of dung he had saved before a quick session of mousing, and after that falling asleep. Well, that's part of a series of poems about 19th century subjects, which makes up the second bit of this book. And the third part of it is to do with things which are in one way or another commissioned. It's become evident to me that some people, though I'm sure not in Warwick, think that being poet laureate and feeling obliged from time to time to write poems about events in the royal calendar means that from time to time, those times to time, somebody comes around from Buckingham Palace wearing a frock coat with a kind of silver tray in front of them on which is a stiff card that says, "My sister feels ill. Will you write about her?" Or somebody's getting married. Will you do that? Or, but there's absolutely no guidance whatsoever, in fact, from that quarter, which is just as well. I mean, not because it might not be interesting, but because you want to remain a kind of free agent, insofar as that can be done. But quite a lot of letters come out of the blue saying, "Will I write about this or that?" Still, in fact, a lot of letters still. "Dear Mr. Mason, you don't know me. I'm getting married on Saturday. Will you write me a poem?" No. Or perhaps if you pay me. And then occasionally letters from people who give me ideas that I wish I'd had myself. And I'm grateful for these, as we all would be. So when the letter comes from, and I've done a number of these, but partly I should say because I want to try and redefine, I mean, really I think of being laureate as coming in two parts. There's a writing bit and there's a doing bit. The doing bit is essentially to do with education, with bullying the government about the curriculum, and just trying to protect and promote poems within academies of all kinds. And then there's the writing bit, which in a sense is described by precedent, because there is this expectation that the poet laureate will write poems about events in the royal calendar, which is not always a very easy thing to do. And I thought that one of the ways of making this seem as though it belonged in now, in a more realistic way, would be to stretch that definition and say that I would try and write poems about national things of one kind or another, as and when I felt able to do this, either in response to invitations or off my own bat. So when the letter came from the people doing the national census, well, that was my first reaction as well, came saying, "Would I write something for them?" I thought, as you've just suggested I might have done. And then I thought, actually, this is very interesting. What what the national census does once every 10 years is to try, in its crude, approximating way, to give us an account of who we are, whom we've become since this was last done. So I wrote this for them, which, as you see, is written since I finished that book. It's called All of Us. It's written in rather wonky couplets, and it begins with that famous passage in, well, phrase in Piers Plowman about the field full of folk. All of us. Who would ever think a field full of folk meant wet eyes and lips smattered among rose hips and bright shining faces bobbing in silver grasses? No, our sense of folk comes in stadium hulks with steamrollering chants of implacable want. But it's all the same. As we shuttle through time, we might or might not change skin colour, forget history, love God, or prefer ourselves instead. The question of who we are still goes on before, a bow wave we watch, creaming, but cannot catch. Or so I thought, that grey day on the coast. I strode off with my dad along a sand spine made by wind fighting waves. Him near the end of his life, me in the middle. Our shoes gave that definite soft kiss of people leaving their mark. But when I looked back, the tide had swallowed us both. That is the truth. And then there's a section at the end of the book which is made up of elegies, more poems about God, and some love poems. And I just want to read one of these elegies, which is a poem that I wrote for a friend of mine whose name is Sarah Raphael. She was a painter about 10 years younger than me, whose work I knew very glancingly before I met her, because she painted that painting, which some of you will know of, I think it's called Guardian Women or something like that, that hangs in the National Portrait Gallery and shows Posy Simmons and Polly Toynbee and Jill Tweedy and some others. It's a kind of group portrait, as you gather. It's not actually a very good painting, but it's a very interesting subject. And I'd noticed it, and I'd looked at it, and thought about it. And then some years ago, the magazine Modern Painters wrote to me and said, would I like to write about Sarah Raphael's work? And I said, well, you know, I would love to, I'm sure, but I don't know very much about it. And they said, well, she has a new show of... She's just come back from Australia. She's painted these huge canvases, desert paintings, that she's done in and after coming back from Australia that are... in her gallery in wherever it was. Would I go and see them and write about them? So I said yes, and off I went. And I thought they were terrific. And met her, and I thought she was terrific as well. Skittish and clever, and the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. And very beautiful in her spirit as well. So I became friendly with her and with her family, and then with her husband and with her children, who in those days were very young, their children. And then she died about 18 months ago, over a weekend, you know, fell ill on Friday and was dead on Monday. And this poem that I wrote for her is not really about her so much, though there are certain things about her and what she did, but it's about hearing that she was dead. It's called The Message in Memory of Sarah Raphael. A crystal midwinter Saturday dawn, and the names of things the same as things themselves, flash over frost sealing my garden square, the ash tree perfectly matched by its ghost in mist. Unshakable hush through the street. I take it all in as I climb the stairs to my room, completely at home, yet free as a bubble in water, wanting for nothing except the handful of cash and jacket I need before I go out to the world. And here on my desk is the toad-head jewel in my telephone winking. Why should I answer it now? This moment is mine. But I do. I answer it feeling the terror which started inside me a lifetime ago. And that's how I hear you are dead. The peaceable street, the ash in its trance, the frost. These all look exactly the same. What's new is the crash of them splitting apart from their names. Not you, Sarah. Not you. I rang your number and heard your voice on the answer phone. Undeliberate grace in a message rush and your hasty fall on the word goodbye, though you were well when you set it down, and never knew how it might endure, outliving you like the travelling light of a snuffed-out star, spearheaded to meet the ignorant stare of us below, who blink and look and are not sure which things to take in our little mist of breath by breath, as signs of life and which of death. In your telephone, the tape has been changed, and now the glib machine remembers only a new regime. In your desk, a tidy number of unopened letters lie, bearing your name and the brand of missing days. In your studio, the bubble cartoons of all your brilliant ideas have reached the ceiling and stuck and will not stir. In your children's room, the spine of a favorite book is aching to bend, open, and let the story end. Well, I'll just read a few more poems, perhaps some more recent things. As I was saying to Peter and David and others before we came in, I spend a lot of time on trains, and they're all late. And as I particularly said to Peter, I think that some quite serious psychic damage has been done to me by this, because I feel that the only way to get them moving again is to kind of in some way connect my will to the engine or to the wires above or whatever it is and just make it happen. So by the time I get off, I'm usually completely eviscerated by the strain of making the train work. But of course sometimes they stop in interesting places and then you think, all right, well I better turn this moment to advantage so that at least when I'm quivering in an institution somewhere I will have done this. And this is a poem I wrote quite recently called The Middle of Nowhere. Then the train stopped without warning or reason, and each of us shrank in the shell of ourselves, turned to the window view chance had allotted us, mine the quince junk field, where plonked on the mud slide shore of a flood pond, this black metal desk chair. I reasoned I'd owned it in some pre-existence, when I was the monarch of trolleys and car doors, bust cases and suit wrecks. Now it just gaped there to show me my kingdom could not do without me, preserving its rain-pitted focus of blankness, catching in sun gleams that version of purity reached by dead things with no further to fall, and bound to persist at the squiffed edge of vision through all the time left of my exile in plenty. Perhaps I should send it to Railtrack, along with the poem that I'm going to send to Lemsip, now that... Honestly, in all my life, I mean, the things that I've tried to get public attention for, writing in schools, the homeless, you name it, and then you talk about Lemsip and the world goes completely berserk. The funniest thing of all about it, and I did mean it as a sort of joke, though it is true, was that remark that some of you may have seen from the man who works for the people who own Lemsip, saying, now we do not wish to advertise the poetry writing properties of Lemsip, and no, we do not do sponsoring, so I'm afraid we're going to have to disappoint Professor Motion in that respect. Anyway, I think they could just send me a few sachets, since I've... don't say much for their product. In the last chapter of St. John's Gospel, he talks, among other things, about that moment when Christ appears on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. and appears to the disciples who are fishing. Many of you will remember this wonderful moment. And while he's standing there, and they on the boat aren't in the early stages of this quite sure who he is, that's part of the magic of this little episode story. While he's standing there, he calls out to them and advises them that they're fishing off the wrong side of the boat. You all remember. They've clearly been fishing off one side of the boat for some time, and they've caught nothing. And this figure appears on the shore and says, "Fish off the other side." So they do, rather surprisingly, taking advice from a landlubber. They do, and they immediately catch a great many fish. And those of you who know this bit of the gospel or happen to remember it by some means, well, remember, he doesn't actually just say they caught a lot of fish. He says they caught 153 fish. It's a wonderful moment. When John was there, he counted, and like all fishermen, and I'm very keen on fishing myself, so I know this, he counted them because they were so pleased. I mean, the only surprising thing is that he doesn't mention the size of the biggest one, I think, in this, which would be even more authentically fishermanly. But perhaps sea fishermen don't do that. Anyway, there are 153. It turns out that from about the year AD 36 to about the year 2000, that theologians have spilt gallons of ink over explaining why there were 153 fish, and indeed it does turn out to be one of those curious multiples. But I think there were 153 fish because he counted it. And when I was reading it recently, I was thinking about this, and I noticed again for the first time, or I'd noticed it once and had since forgotten, that he also says that there was a fire on the beach. And I suppose this really is a barbecue that they'd lit before they set off on their fishing trip, because what they caught, they were going to eat, or they were going to eat some of it before they sold the rest in, wherever, Galilee. Anyway, it's a transcendent and beautiful story which asks very difficult and interesting questions about faithfulness, but it also has these wonderful bolts of human and recognizable actuality in it. And this is the little poem I've written about it, which is called Simple. Men came from the sea with their unusual catch, 153. A fire burned on the beach. They had expected nothing. Now there was a glut. And also this man waiting. The charcoal was white hot. But was the man there? One moment it seemed so, the next he was not. "Master," they said, "don't go." Like thin air shimmering when powerful heat bakes it, he continued his waiting, indefinite, definite. The fire burned on the beach with their unusual catch. They had expected nothing. Now there was too much. I just want to read two more poems, if I may. There are many reasons for envying, possibly, certainly admiring other poets, and one of the ones which I most commonly experience is the envy of people being funny, which I would love to be in poems, because people like laughing, and it would be nice to do for people what they like doing. And I just can't. But I can sort of do wry. So here's Rye. Well, as close as I can get to Rye, anyway. It's a childhood memory, all true, again written in these sort of rickety couplets. Indeed, the poem uses the word rickety. About being taken as a child to watch a game of cricket in which my father was taking part in a rather comical way. Cricket. I like cricket, actually, now, but I didn't then. Once upon a time, I'm a boy dragged off to cricket, pinned by heat in rickety desk chair arms, and safe from harm except for the undone button and yellow lips of cotton. There, at my mother's breast, where, tell her, a glimpse of naked skin draws in the dangerous gaze of strangers. And, on the other hand, more than a little concerned, having just discerned my father sprinting in from long on, blinded by sun, to snatch an almost impossible catch, but really about to crash, watch out, into the equally passionate fellow herring round from the shadier side of the ground. Mine, they shout, when they're about to collide. And in that second I wonder, which side am I on? Am I my father's son or my mother's? Whose hurt matters most and will be remembered best? The open yellow dress, the ball falling, and all my life to come balanced while I stayed dumb, knowing whichever I chose, I was bound to lose. And I'd like to end, please, by reading this slightly longer poem that I warned you about, which has three sections to it, and it's not that long, so don't worry. There is a kind of geographical common thing in it. The first part is set in a graveyard. The second part is set on an island where I've spent the last 18, or part of the last 18 summers, and don't expect to go again because it's now changed. I mean, the place where I used to go, where we used to go, has now changed hands. And the last part is set in Dorset, in and around Bockhampton, which is, of course, where Hardy was born. So there's that. It's a love poem. It's also a poem which has something to do with driving, which explains, in part, the title, which is Fiat. Fiat is, of course, the name of a car, but it also means other things that I don't need to explain in a university. It's written in a very free verse, like talk, I hope. Fiat. We barely knew one another. Our friend had died. That brought us together and bolted us through with an electric charge of nervousness and devotion. In the sweet pine whiff of a hired car, nervousness got the upper hand. How did the lights work? We had no idea. It didn't matter. Just as the falling dusk, the lanes closing into country, the shut-up married villages didn't matter. They were part of the conspiracy of things which believed in us. We began to believe in ourselves. At the lych gate, with a burglar light etching the churchyard, it was your real hand burrowing through my arm, steering me off the path and into the tragi-comedy gothic of toppled headstones and thick shadows. Where was our friend exactly? We had no idea. Floating from one scrawny flower bank to the next, trusting our instincts. It was just as well. He lay outside the pale of the burglar light, between a mammoth yew and a stand of pine trees opening onto bare fields. A moon sea, an empty ocean. His own earth was hidden under a lily bank of extravagant trumpets and slithery frogskin leaves. We leaned into each other as though we had grown like that, rooted in silence and sorrow. But quickening, the pine trees hissed like surf. A pigeon stirred on its roost, applauded, and settled again. How long we stayed, is a good question, like how your head came to lie on my shoulder. But I know this. At one time or another, I saw our anonymous car in the lane, the interior light, which had never switched off, and one or two hairs, surely pressed into the seats. 18 summers on the island, then my last summer. Everything I saw was a sign, each sunset, each folding wave, part of the same elegy, though I wanted them at face value and to think about them later. But the stars or myself made this impossible. As I drove from the beach after an early swim, my car lost power. This was not exceptional. It was a cream and rust jalopy, half as old as I was. There had been other days. I hated it for giving up. But this was different. I lost power, then lost everything, gliding to a dead halt on the sliver of road above the bay, with a genie of brown smoke raging under the bonnet and flame claws pincering the windscreen. I primly closed the door, then with my head twisted round, devil watching, legged it back up the slope where I stared, up to my knees in scratchy fennel. What is there in a car to burn? Rubber pipes behind the dashboard, which fused and started a pathetic whinny of the engine trying to leave. Then when the knee holes gave way, the carpets, with their holiday scruff of sand and sweet papers and parking permits, the seats sticky with sun cream, the black plastic knob of the gear stick, finger grips of the steering wheel, headrests, foot pedals, the spare tire. All these had started to lose their shape when I remembered my bag on the back seat, and inside it my mobile, hoarding the one number I could not do without, your number. There was nothing for it but go back and hoik it out, arm over my face, nose and mouth clamped against the rubber stink. I did this and thought nothing of it, except how the fire billowed larger the instant I backed off, licking its lips against the roof, punching the windows out, banging from front to back like a dog scaring a passerby, ripping the bonnet up and the tailgate so the whole inside was humbled and splayed open, no hiding places left, no record of anywhere it had taken me. 10 minutes and it was over, the mushroom cloud losing its head, metal already creaking as it cooled. I gave it another 10 and gingerly walked up. It was the same car in X-ray, the chassis a blue-black ash shell, smouldering seat skeletons, the gouged-out, weeping eye of the speedometer, and in the boot, a silver sunshade, just spokes in the central pole, with no handle. There was only one thing to think. I must call you. I had my mobile for that, with its complete knowledge of what the future held. I must call you and tell you I had survived. The future was herring off in a new direction, taking me with it as I pressed the numbers out, the stronger sun waking the aniseed fennel smell by the time I got through, rounding out the bay with a quick succession of delicate flicks and licks when we started to speak. We kept our feet on the ground, but our thoughts were of falling, falling and rising. At Lyme first, on the meandering bowed blocks of the Cobb, where Louisa Musgrove was jumped down into and through the captain's arms. Then at Ford, where the big fist of a summer storm punched a young man of the house once off the abbey roof into thin air, but also caught him, ballooning his cottons and silks, so he came to earth like a spider, saved in its own web. And we ourselves were falling, driving the bare valley flanks, then under splintering lane canopies of ruinous holly armour and beech. Love was drawing us down into the flash-lit underbrush where things seen for the first time are familiar and recognized. We had no idea where our destination might be until we found it, Hardy's cottage at Bockhampton, with the whispering wood sea swallowing the hill behind and the field foam before us withering to the silver scratch, which might be sea or sky. In the squished window seat where he wrote under the greenwood tree, our backs were warm in the sun, our faces cool from the white stare of the room. At the time to leave, a young man brushed us on his way indoors, the battered pale frock coat, obviously his best, but the pockets bulged open by the weight of a hand withdrawn. He climbed the old nest we had just flown and watched us melt by degrees through the cottage beds. Soon afterwards, dusk closed in, mussing his face in the frame. But we were away by then, driving wherever we chose, the evening star like a satellite, rising towards the moon, and that soft place in its arms.
I think I'm right in saying that Andrew has to leave by around 1:30 or something like that, yeah. But that means there's time for questions, if anyone has any. And I think the protocol is I'm supposed to repeat the questions so that it all goes down on tape.
Now you come.
Anyone with a question, raise your hand. And is there a chance of getting the house lights up a little so I could see any hands raised? Somebody in the front I can see. Hi. What's the question?
What you wrote earlier.
Yeah.
Should I turn this on?
The question is, does Wordsworthian romanticism offer a tenable poetics for the 21st century?
Well, it does to me.
There you go. Any other takers? Over there.
It's a very complicated thing, this. I mean, your question has many facets to it, and one of them is about the question of how you respond to commissioned work, and the other is whether or not you feel a sort of burden on you to say certain sorts of thing because you occupy a certain position. I mean, that there are other aspects to it as well, but those are two things which I spend a great deal of time thinking about. And the way that I've solved it for myself, in order to keep my sanity through it, though it may not be very much more than that, is to say that there need not be a great difference between what you experience when you're, as it were, commissioning yourself to write a poem and what you experience when you're being commissioned by an external agency of one kind or another to write a poem. In other words, when any writer gets an idea which they want to write for themselves or for the people they think are their usual readers or the audience that they have in mind in whatever way, the idea comes, you try out in your head various verse forms, you try out various angles of entry, you try out attitudes, the whole kind of range of stuff that anybody writing a poem is thinking about before they put pen to paper. And then if you decide to, if you're able to go ahead with it, you get a kind of green light moment. And so you try. It might not work, but you at least try it. I've persuaded myself that there need not be a very great difference between that and the things which come, as it were, through the post or on a telephone or by whatever means, which is to say that somebody suggests that you write a poem about homelessness or whatever the thing might be, liberty, if it's the which I try to write about for the TUC or whatever these things are. Or even the Queen Mum dies and you say, I would like to do this for whatever reasons are relevant in the situation. Can I do it? If I were to do it, how would I do it? And then you go through exactly the kind of same set of possibilities as you do, I go through exactly the same sort of set of possibilities that I would go through if I were writing it just for myself. And if you don't get the green light moment, don't do it. It would be perfectly possible for me to occupy this position and crank out ditties or string words together, because you assume at least that anybody who is doing this has a certain facility for words. Of course, I could crank something out, but it has to feel to me, if to nobody else, but it has to feel to me like an authentic poem. And if it doesn't, if that sense of authenticity doesn't occur, then don't finish it or don't release it. But you're quite right to identify this as something that does preoccupy me greatly. There's another aspect to it which I just quickly would like to mention, if I may, which is to say that, like everybody else with their heads screwed on, I think that poetry must preserve a sense of the adversarial about it. It must have something in it which is kind of against the grain or counter-suggestive or something which is not merely biddable. And that also is something that I spend a great deal of time thinking about, how to preserve that kind of grain in the things when, sure, there is a certain expectation on me to write in certain ways about some things. And my solution to that is to say, is not to say, I will now write a poem attacking the royal family, which would clearly be kind of ridiculous for me to do, because if I wanted to do that, I shouldn't have accepted the position in the first place. But to say, let's try and engage with this subject when I do try and engage with it in a way which is not merely sycophantic or kowtowing or trying to fall into line with some sort of typically royalist line on it, but to try and find a kind of interesting angle on it in some way or another. Well, you don't always, of course, but that too is a very good question. I think that crudely, what I mean about it, and of course it's a complicated thing, is that the poem which you feel that surprises you, and is therefore likely perhaps to surprise your reader as well. If we think that poems that work better than the ones which don't work are written as a result of some kind of negotiation being made between the side of your mind which does know what's going on and is readily, writerly, manipulative, interventionist, and generally kind of on the case, and a side of your mind which frankly hasn't got a clue what's happening, that balance must be preserved. And many, many poets before me have put that antithesis, but that's what it is in their own terms, but that's my account of it. Larkin talks about knives and forks. Many people have talked about left-hand and right-hand side of the brain, all that kind of thing, yin and yang, you name it. The inauthentic poem to me feels like the one which is either, well, probably mainly the poem which is written too much from the right-hand side, the too deliberated poem, the poem which aspires to spell an exact proposition rather than the one which has this element of self-surprise and therefore of audience surprise embedded in it. Of course, there's no guarantee that what surprises you will inevitably surprise your reader, but you can't worry about that too much without sending yourself bonkers, I think. And you just, if you satisfy yourself in some very demanding way, and of course there is a question begged there about how demanding you are of yourself, but very must be the answer, then that has to be the moment of release if you've satisfied yourself in that way.
Question in the back there? Luigi. Hi.
You said something about how we poets
Well, that's also very interesting, and it's very difficult to put a kind of figure on it. For the last 7 years, I've run the Creative Writing MA program at UEA, which has meant that I've taught the prose course and the poetry course. When I got there, taking it over from Malcolm Bradbury in 1995, there was just one prose group. Now it's a much more diverse thing. There's a life writing bit, there's a script and screen bit, which was embryonic when I started, but is now very developed, evolved. There are two prose groups, there's one poetry group. and from the beginning of this academic year, I boiled myself down so that I would just run the poetry course, and I no longer have anything to do with the prose. And the reason for this is simply that the rest of my life is now so frantic that I cannot do everything. The difficult thing, the pleasures of it are probably self-evident. I have extraordinarily good students, as I'm sure you who are doing it here have as well, and perhaps you're one of them. They're very smart. They have a wonderful combination of being intensely practical, ambitious, and being full of willingness to take risks and chances and all that. So that's a very good mixture of things. And a lot of them have a great success in the world. I mean, there's an amazingly high kind of hit rate if you want to measure the success or failure of it in terms of who gets published. It is very successful in those terms. So all kinds of things about it have been very pleasing. I must say, as far as its impact on my own writing is concerned, I think that I'm more conscious of what I need to suppress about its effect than I am of what I need to enhance about it, which is to say that it's provokes in me, and this takes us back to what we were saying a second ago, everything that is articulating and articulatable. And that's not always a good thing to have being dominant when you're writing poems. In fact, it's never a good thing, I think, to be dominant when you're writing poems. So I try and flick a kind of switch between the way I am when I'm teaching and the way I am when I'm writing. In much the same way, I must say, as I flick a switch between when I'm writing biography or writing reviews, even, and when I'm writing poems. It requires a different combination of bits of your brain. And I often speak about this with the students and say that when they're in the workshop, they're invoking different things in themselves than those things that they're invoking when they're actually sitting at their desk and doing their work. Where the balance, again, once again, the balance is different. The balance between what's sort of foggy, murky, and rising up from their deep, unknown subconscious, and what's manipulating, calculating, and all those. Whereas in the workshop, I want them to be absolutely kind of, you know, needle sharp about the effects and revisabilities and so on of what they're doing. I wish I did. Well, when Peter was, I wish I knew, because it might be more stimulatable than Lemsip seems able to do. But when Peter was saying earlier that I'd said that I'd write poems in a kind of biological way, actually I think what he was remembering was that I did, rather unadvisedly, ill-advisedly, once say that I did think that writing poems was biological, and actually I still think that. It's just that here I am saying it again, so what can we do? By which I really meant to say that I wrote a poem a month, and if I was worried, if I was late, I worried. And it sort of has been like that through my life. I mean, there is a sort of something, I mean, it evidently has something to do with self-definition, but it also has to do clearly with the kind of time it takes my mind to regather itself and to look around and think of something else and so on. I terrifically envy people who write more often than that, but I can't, and actually it's slowed down quite a lot now from that. So every 6 weeks. But quite a lot during, I mean, for quite a lot of those 6 weeks, I'll be, as we again were saying earlier, trying things out and seeing what's what. And you never stop being a poet in waiting, though you might not always be the poet on the job. So you're reading the newspapers, listening to your friends, listening to the radio. I mean, your antennae are always kind of working, of course, and I'm sure you. It looks as though you recognize this, and I'm sure it's the same for you and for everybody else who writes poems. But it's not always that the case that they pick up the thing which is trackable or writable. So there's usually something going on, but often it's very far away, very long way away from being a poem proper or a poem you might keep. And of those, of the poems I write every 6 weeks or whatever it is, I suppose I keep about one in three. There's a very high failure rate. Alas. Well, that's very nice, and especially, of course, when I'm listening to music, and which I probably spend more time doing now than I do reading, actually. But you, it sounds as though you might do the same. But when I'm listening to music, there are so many things going on, some of which I can speak about, and some of which I can't. But so many of my thoughts, all our thoughts, I dare say, when we're listening to music, are inchoate to the point of being inexpressible, really, or rather embarrassingly sort of humdrum. And I mean, even at the moments of the most intense musical crisis, you can find yourself thinking about daily things. But also, and this is more to the point, I find myself spending a lot of time thinking about the form that music has. If you listen to, which I often do, and perhaps you do too, symphonies by Mahler, whom I'm very keen on, I quite routinely have the very banal thought, listening to the first 15 or 20 minutes of a Mahler symphony, how on earth are all those different themes and motifs and noises going to be brought into a whole by the end of this thing? Wouldn't it be wonderful to write a poem like that, to just put all these things down in the opening movement of it, the poem, and then spend the poem getting them on terms with each other, reconciling them, elaborating them, and all this. So I do envy musical form and think about it in a way which I hope then might feed back into poems. And increasingly writing short poems, I think, write a song. Not by which I don't simply mean something which could be sung, but write something which has that sort of pure dart feeling about it. So I suppose this is rather a rambling answer to your question, but it's not really a question of switching off. It's more a question of looking for roughly equivalent sympathetic things in a brother-sister form that you might be able to learn something from. Interestingly, actually, having said that about Mahler, though probably only interesting to me, about 3 or 4 years ago I fell seriously ill and spent a long time in hospital thinking I was going to die, and went into hospital thinking, how am I going to deal with this? Well, I'll listen to all my favourite composers. So I took in masses of Mahler and The Ring and the kind of stuff that I was listening to at the time, and expected to be consoled by it. And when as I started to recover from this, I simply didn't have the wherewithal to listen to big band music. I just couldn't deal with it. So I started to listen to much earlier music, Bach in particular, but also Purcell and other musicians who write in a sense on a smaller scale. I mean, there are a few people in the orchestra at least, and I'd never lost my taste for that. And I found it very difficult to go back to these other people. I still listen to Mahler a lot, but I listen to this earlier stuff much more now than I used to.
And aren't you a Bob Dylan fan too?
And then there is Dylan. Yes. Well, I am very, very, very interested in Dylan, it's true. Uh-huh. And I would love to write about him, except I think that it's probably quite a good idea not to write about all the things you love, because you must keep something for yourself. Uh-huh. But yes, I am very interested in Dylan, who means a lot to me, mm-hmm. Because of the noises that he makes and because of the things that he has to say.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
I think he's a raving genius.
Well, 1 minute left. One more question.
The 1 minute.
Anybody?
Answer.
How about over there?
Yeah. When you were growing up, when and how did you realize you wanted to be a poet? Well, Patrick Kavanagh's great thing about you dabble in verses and it becomes your life is something that Puccini is fond of quoting. It's something that I recognize. I started to write poems when I was sort of 16, 17, when my mother had that accident that I described in the first poem that I read. It seemed imperative at the time to try and put something back into life to make, to fill in the hole that her absence had left. And then other things happened and you want to write about other things, or at least take the things that I wanted to take, the things I'd been thinking about in connection with her, out into a wider range of experience, and I still do want that, though she is the sort of prompt for it all, I guess. Your question kindly presupposes or supposes that there's a moment when you feel that you've kind of got it, but of course you never feel that. You never feel happy with what you've been doing. The poem I'm going to write tomorrow is hot shit. But all the stuff up to now, you know, so there's, it feels much more restless than you, than your kind question allows it to seem, and unhappy and disappointed. And, but I suppose without that feeling of disappointment, maybe you'd stop or get complacent or whatever.
Well, I think it only remains for me to thank Andrew Motion for coming to Warwick and to thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you.